Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your outpost for the week is freshly delivered, and I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and here with me, as she is every single week, the one and only Trey Kaufman.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Doing all right.
Nice. Nice. It's just kind of like in the middle of the summer, and it's not been an exceedingly exciting summer, you know? So I kind of feel like Harry in the fifth book, right? Where summer has just kind of been this drudgery of heat and boredom because nothing's happening. Yep. So, but I mean,
all of that.
Yeah. At least you have the pool. So, I mean,
except for I can't go in the pool right now.
No. Oh, because of the surgery, right?
Because of the surgery. Yeah. I can't be completely, emerged. Mm-hmm. In the water right yet. I've talked with friends about hiking my leg up on the side of the pool, and it's just not worth it. It's not worth it for such a short period of time.
That's true. Yeah. Yep. Not as much fun when you have to worry so much about like getting it wet. But really cool, Drea. We have gotten three emails just this week from different listeners. We got one from Mia, from Steve, and from Sitta, and they have all told us how much they love Owl Posts. And I don't know about you, but that just made my week.
It does. It's so exciting.
It is.
I like hearing from everyone.
Well, we just appreciate people doing that, you know. If you want to send us an email, we love getting the emails. You can go over to thenerdparty.com/contact, and you can send us an email as well. You can find us on Twitter at @joinnerdparty. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thenerdparty. You can also find us on Instagram at @thenerdparty. And then, of course, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And so if you're doing that, please give us a star rating and review, especially if you're on Apple Podcasts. Help people find the show. And, of course, we also read out those reviews that we get as well. So so many different places to find us. But this week, Drea, we're in Chapter 6 of The Deathly Hallows and The Ghoul in the Pajamas. And this chapter is, I would say, a slight reprieve from the intense morbidity that we've had in the last few chapters, where like the death and the destruction and the pain and the sadness, like some of that is gone here, although there are actually some tears in this chapter. So, but this one definitely just kind of felt like I needed a break. And she also gives us some really important information in this chapter, too, about some things that we haven't really known a lot about, like Horcruxes. So it was definitely a nice chapter to read after the beginning of this book, which just started off with a bang.
Yeah, there's a little bit of dreariness as we start. And there's some moments when they start thinking about Mad-Eye and what happened with him. And there's some kind of, I don't know, there's some moments in here that aren't lighthearted, but I agree. I think this is kind of as lighthearted as we're going to get for the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Really, let's be honest here. And so, well, there's probably one more chapter that's about the same. But it's interesting. It's very long, though. Like, it's a very long chapter compared to what we've read in the book so far. And a lot happens and a lot doesn't happen. And we're given some information, but really we're just kind of moving along.
Mm-hmm.
We're just kind of moving the story along
here.
And it's really interesting because I think a big part of this, because we can go section by section, but the biggest part, I think, of this chapter really is the very unique response that Mrs. Weasley is having to mm-hmm. literally everything.
Yeah.
That's a kind of main focal point of this, chapter, is she's very much so fighting for the normal way of life as much as possible. And she's doing everything she can, including keeping everyone separate in order to avoid what we all kind of know is the inevitable.
Yeah, I think, that's a good point. You know, this chapter isn't one necessarily I think we have to walk through every single part of it, because I think there are some main keys to it. And like you said, with Mrs. Weasley, Ron warns Harry, you know, here at the beginning of the chapter, you know, just FYI, my mom's probably going to try and pry out of you because she's been trying to do it to Hermione and I for the last couple weeks. What's going on and, you know, what we're planning. You know, Harry's still trying to try and get out of here early, but Hermione and Ron are having none of that, especially since he can't even leave for 5 days anyway. The wedding's in 6 days because, you know, Harry still has the trace on him. And it is fascinating to watch Mrs. Weasley try to weasel this out of Harry, of what Dumbledore had for him. And you know, Harry really stands his ground. And I think it's interesting because it's a hard place for Harry to be, because this chapter is one where Harry is starting to realize the toll and the things that people are giving up to help him. So one of that is his friends, but by the end of the chapter, he has really come to see what he's putting the Weasley family through, especially Mr. and Mrs. Weasley. And I think that progression throughout the chapter just, it goes to show how mature Harry is, in that he is able to stop just thinking about himself and what his role is in all this. And he is able to put himself in other people's shoes and begin to see the cost of all of this for them. And especially with Mrs. Weasley, that plays out all the way to the very end of the chapter, where Harry just, he's like, he doesn't even know how to respond to her. Like when she brings up his birthday at the very end and he's like, he's basically saying it's not important. And she's like, no, of course it's important. And I think he just feels so bad, you know, that everybody is in this position because of him, and he doesn't know how to make it better. And that bothers him because of the person that he is. And I really like this chapter for that reason, because as we've talked about many a times throughout the series, I think this is one of those chapters that really shows Harry's character as he becomes aware of just the enormity that this is for Ron and Hermione, and the enormity that this is for the people around him, like the Weasley family. And I think that's, you know, like you were saying, it's kind of a longer chapter. There's a lot of things that happen. And I think that's one of those things where it's like, it's a little bit longer of a chapter because Harry needs the time to be able to progress from where he is at the start of the chapter to where he is at the end of the chapter, and have that kind of, like, he needs to be able to have the time to allow that emotional journey to feel legitimate, you know?
Yeah, I think that going through the motions of something so normal, in air quotes, of, you know, this wedding happening and everyone kind of fixating their efforts on that, I think helps too, right? It stabilizes Mrs. Weasley's stress regardless. Everyone's stressed with wedding planning. If you're not, then you're lying, because there's this weird cultural pressure around a wedding, whether you think there should be or not. Regardless, there is like this sort of normal thing, right? Like getting married amidst everything happening feels like a way to try and hold on to the way things used to be, right? And so in that sense, it kind of helps, I think, all of them stay a little grounded while they process everything. And I think that's part of what really helps Harry, is he keeps busy and he's got this thing and it kind of feels normal and right. And, you know, he has a moment with Ginny in this chapter where they're alone, and he realizes this is kind of the first time they've been alone since they left Hogwarts. And, you know, there's just little moments that are normal that he gets to take a step back throughout the whole chapter and say, this is not going to be the reality of my life in a little while, right? And yeah, so I have to kind of shift my perspective from expectations. And he tries to bring Ron and Hermione along with them, and sort of learns they're already there. They're already along with them. They're already planning, which is the whole title of the chapter, right? We find that Ron and Hermione are much further along in their sort of acceptance of what's happening than Harry seems to be. You know, we learn that Hermione has sort of confunded her parents into thinking there's someone else, and that they are now in Australia, because she thought the further away they could get, the less likely they'd be to be hunted down. I love that she has this moment where she says, you know, because to be quite honest, I've told them quite a bit about you, You know, I like that that's the moment, and that, you know, Ron has thought ahead about how they're going to handle Ron leaving. And I like that there's this moment where everyone but Mrs. Weasley is on board. His dad, oh, my dad, they helped me do it. He knows, but we've decided that we'll tell her that she's only going to accept this when it's over. And, you know, but otherwise we're basically good to go, right? There's this moment where I think when they've shared that, Harry sort of really realizes what's happening here and that this is happening, right? Mm-hmm. So, I agree. It's a long chapter and we get there, but, and that all happens kind of near the end of the chapter.
Right.
So, you know, that they've been packing books and planning this for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I just think the whole thing is interesting. It gets you there. And there's a few, I think there's a few really important moments in the chapter, at least that I could identify. The first one is sort of that initial confrontation with Mrs. Weasley over the sock. Where she starts to ask Harry whether that's his sock, in order to get him away and alone from everyone else. But the thing in that moment that to me really stood out was that he looked into her eyes for kind of the first time and realized her eyes are the same as Ginny's eyes. And for some reason, that moment sticks with me. And it made it harder for Harry to withhold the information from her because of who he could see in her. And that to me was kind of just a beautiful moment, kind of sad, but beautiful. And I thought that whole exchange, though, was, I mean, Mrs. Weasley is way more clever than I think the rest of the books have ever given her credit for. Like, she does a phenomenal job of manipulating the situation.
No, I agree with you. I really liked that moment with her. And I also thought that then the moment he has with Ginny has even more like gravitas to it, because, you know, she and he have this quick moment, and Ginny's like, I think mom thinks that if we keep you guys apart this whole time, that it'll delay you guys leaving. And Harry's response is somewhat funny, and he's not necessarily thinking when he's like, oh, so like we should just let somebody else kill Voldemort, like, well, we, you know, basically make patty cakes, you know. And she and Ginny has not heard basically that this idea of that it's going to come down to the two of them. And so she's like, wait, so it's true what you're trying to do? And Harry's like, no, I was just joking. You know, like, so there's this uncomfortableness then between them. And in fact, there's a moment because everybody in the order is coming to dinner there, and Harry ends up at the table a few times next to Ginny, and like there's so many people, he's like, he's trying not to even touch her so he can barely cut his food, just because it's so charged, right, between them. And there's so much, I'm sure, that he wants to say at this moment. He doesn't have the words to say it. And I think, you know, that's something that's really interesting. And that kind of plays into the moment that he has with, like you were talking about, with Ron and Hermione. He does the thing where he's going to like, guys, you don't need to come with me. And they're like, oh, here it comes. And then they both basically show him how much they've been putting into this already. And one, Harry's blown away so that he's speechless. He can't even explain to his friends how much this means to him. But two, he's also speechless because Ron is the one who's showing the most tact in this whole thing with Hermione and really being there for her as she's having a very hard time dealing with all of this, in the sense that, like, it's emotional for her with what she's doing to her, with her parents, and the fact that, you know, somebody like Mad-Eye that they knew was already dead, and, like, the reality of what they're going to go do. And so, that leaves Harry speechless as well, which is one of the funniest parts of the chapter, when he's thinking to himself, man, I'm learning tact from Ron. I never thought that would be possible. Because as we've saw, especially in that last book, Ron was tactless. He has definitely grown up quite a bit in how to deal with
feelings.
Feelings, yeah. And female feelings, which he had no way of dealing with even two books ago, right? So that was just a real difference here in this story. And I think it's a progression as we're watching them all grow up. Another really important issue that I found was all the conversations that happened around the dinner table as they're talking about what's going on with the government. And we learn that nothing has gotten out in the Daily Prophet about this attack. The fact that Scrimgeour hasn't let anything out, and he doesn't really want people to know how powerful Voldemort is at this point. You know, the fact that they had this mass breakout, and Harry just is like, yeah, why tell people the truth? You know, and he can clearly still see on his hand the scar of I must not tell lies. But the fascinating thing is Mr. Weasley responds to the kids and reminding them, guys, people are terrified. They have no idea who's going to, you know, like, who's going to be gone next. You know, people are scared for their kids with all the rumors going around. And he's like, and of course, we go back to the fact that the Muggle Studies professor from Hogwarts, Mr. Weasley doesn't believe that she just disappeared. And he's like, I don't know what's going on with Scrimgeour, but I hope he's working on a plan at least. But at least Mr. Weasley can kind of see, like, this situation is so bad, it is kind of a place where you don't want people to know just how bad it is, really. And I like that she doesn't really, this is one of the places where she does not, I think, give us a clear-cut idea of how she feels about all this, because I think it's two good points, and I don't even know if I think what I know is best in this situation.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I think, you know, we talk a lot about Mr. Weasley and his loyalty and the family of the Weasleys in general, and for them to, I don't want to say coup, but for them to believe that their government, that he not only abides by the rules of, but works for, has kind of gone the way, and to actually kind of talk openly about it, and he, you know, he's doing... It's so interesting, he still has this faith that Scrimgeour might actually be working for something good. It's just got this optimism behind it that not many others probably would echo in this, you know. Most would just say, like, just burn it down, we're done with it, right? But yeah, it's there's so much that happens and comes out. And part of it, too... we learn in these conversations over dinner is another kind of conversation that strikes up with me is that Flora asks, you know, who Harry is going to be disguised as for the wedding. And she sort of throws some shade towards Hagrid in that she still thinks that he can't be trusted. And Harry picks up on this and it gets into a whole thing about, you know, the fact that the secret keeping of, you know, Grimmauld Place is going to fall away. There's too many people. And it goes back to that whole secret keeper thing that, you know, it was Dumbledore who's now dead. And so all bets are off, right? So I just think it's interesting. We learn a lot and there's kind of a lot of things that are old and brought back and a lot of like things that are tied back together. And then there's still some sort of dissension, I guess, across the group, and there's some trust, but there's still kind of some little cracks through it. And I just think this kind of stab at Hagrid kind of stuck with me a little bit.
Yeah, and it is interesting.
I mean, she's right. Disguise him. Absolutely. I don't disagree with that, but you know, the connotation behind it. I mean, it's definitely the smart thing to do, but the kind of connotation and the way it really resonates with Harry, right? It speaks to him.
I mean, absolutely. And it's one of those things to which Harry realizes, obviously, that Hagrid, it was not a purpose. It was an accident, you know, and he's able to accept that. But that when we're looking at, and we were kind of talking about at the beginning, the reality of the sacrifice that all of these people are making, it makes sense that you cannot just be thinking about one person in that situation. You have to be thinking about the whole. And, mm-hmm. you know, obviously for Harry, it's a little bit harder to do that because, you know, Hagrid is so close to him. But I think that's the interesting thing about this chapter is that all of these conversations and everything that happens in it, by the end, I think Harry is much more cognizant of the fact that there are so many more people involved in this than just him and Ron and Hermione and like Hagrid and his closest, you know, people. Like, there's so much more at stake here, and it's affecting so many more people. And I think that's a big part of this whole chapter, is getting Harry to that place to be able to see that. And yes, Fleur may be a little bit insensitive with the way that she
transparent
yeah throws that out, right? But she's not necessarily wrong, especially when you think about all of the people that are involved here,
right?
And so a slip up like what happened in the first book could cost the entire order their lives, and end this whole thing very quickly. So I mean,
yeah,
that's the I think the worst case scenario of it all. But they have to be thinking about those kind of things, right? So,
right. Yeah, it's just kind of a notable thing. It brings up exactly what you just said, right? It calls out exactly that they need to be more careful than they maybe had to be. And they have to be, and there is some distrust there, and probably rightfully so, right? You have to trust, but you also have, it's what trust, but verify, right?
Yeah,
they have
absolutely.
To cover their CYA, but also, have a little bit of faith. But yeah, I mean, they're gonna, so we also learn that they're gonna be disguising Harry when he is at the wedding, which is kind of the first time we've heard about that, which does not happen in the movie, by the way.
Right. No, not at all. But it actually makes sense, you know, like J.K. Rowling knows what she's doing. Like, it makes so much more sense that he would need to be disguised, because even though they don't believe that anybody coming to the wedding would turn in Harry, they can't be. They also want to be as careful as possible. You know, you just never know.
But they also can't control what happens when those people go. I mean, it's like COVID, right? It's not that you distrust someone to give you, someone's going to intentionally give you COVID, like, but there could be, you know, situations out of their control and it happens that way, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just one of those things where, like, she's just being extra careful,
right?
And, you know, rightfully so. But it's just, yeah, it really sticks with Harry. I think, you know, he takes it a little personally, more so than maybe is necessary. But again, that's another, I think, lesson that he's getting through, is that some of these things, I mean, there's going to be something that happens in this book. I'm not going to spoil it too much, but there is going to be something that happens in this book that is so important and so personally an affront between this trio that, like, I mean, this is just kind of a foreshadowing of a bigger issue that's going to come up. So he's got to get used to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's all in all, it's a very full chapter with a lot of just information. Mm-hmm. And I do love, though, the last thing I really loved is that Mrs. Weasley is trying so hard to keep them all apart. We've kind of mentioned that already. But I really love that right near the end, when we learn about the fact that Ron has dressed up a ghoul in pajamas, which cracks me up. The reason they can all get together is because Mrs. Weasley asks Hermione to do something she had already asked her to do. And so she just went up to the room because, you know, she already did that like 2 days ago. I just think that moment is just so funny, because it just shows how hard Mrs. Weasley is trying to keep them all apart.
Well, and I love that is the time where they finally get to sit down and talk about all of these things. And one of the most important things we learn is this idea of, like, the fact that obviously they're going to be searching for Horcruxes, and Hermione's like, I know you want to go to Godric's Hollow, but where else are we wanting to go in this? And Harry's like, I wish I knew. If I knew where the Horcruxes are, this would definitely be easier. And we learn that Hermione, quote unquote, stole Dumbledore's books that he had in his office, that he had taken out of the library, but of course not destroyed, about all of this dark magic and about these Horcruxes. I love the way she got them too, that at school last year, before they left, she had just accioed these books and they came up to her dormitory through the window. So, but we learn finally about Horcruxes and just how they're made in some ways, and like what this means. And so we learn one important thing, which is The way to destroy one has to be with something to which the magical object cannot repair itself easily. So one of the best ways to destroy a Horcrux is the way Harry did in the second book, which was with the Basilisk Fang, which that venom only has one healing property, which is a Phoenix tier. And so they're like, well, that's great because we just have so many Basilisk Fangs laying around. But the most important thing in this discussion, I think, was where she goes with the idea of the fact that creating a Horcrux, the Horcrux must have, the soul inside must have the Horcrux, because that soul inside doesn't have the human body to keep it alive. If a person dies, its soul goes on. But if the Horcrux dies, the soul inside of it needed that Horcrux. And so the fascinating thing to me is how metaphysical she just gets, like, that, the idea of, like, souls. And, like, I just love the way Hermione's describing it. Like, Ron, if I were to stab you with a sword right now, your soul wouldn't die. And he's like, well, that's just great. And she's like, well, yeah, you should think it is. So, like, we're really getting into some, like, really deep discussions already as to the metaphysical nature then of what these Horcruxes is, how much of an affront to life that they are in the first place, as well as the makeup of what, you know, the belief of the human body and the soul and how that's connected, and that the reason that Voldemort would never be whole again, which is to bring your broken off soul back into yourself and to repair yourself would mean that you would have to actually have true remorse for what you've done. And that is something we know that Voldemort will never have. So this whole discussion to me is phenomenally fascinating when it came to, and again, it's couched in this chapter, and like you could pass over this chapter, but this is going to be pivotal to the entire rest of the book.
Well, and in that case, she sort of starts laying the groundwork here and talks about when you're talking about Horcruxes and your soul never being able to come back, that, you know, is she sort of making a parallel? I mean, in real life, we can't use magic to split our soul into a bunch of pieces and make us live forever. But, you know, there is something to be said about when we do something that that is wrong or an affront to others or against the law or whatnot, right? Like if we don't feel remorse over those actions, a little part of us does kind of die, right? And you become a little less human as you do that. You have a little less feelings, a little less compassion for those around you. And she's kind of laying that groundwork in that, yeah, we can't split our soul with magic, but there's many other ways as a society that we can sort of split our soul and kind of let parts of ourselves go and become more like Voldemort. And it's important to know that we all make, I think her way of putting out there the remorse is we all make mistakes. We all do bad things. We all, you know, no one's perfect. That's just proof of life. We don't exist in this perfect vacuum. But as long as we continue to grow and learn and have remorse and feelings for the things we do, we can stay whole. We can stay human, and we can continue down this path of not being like figures like Voldemort. And I think that that's an important part of a Horcrux, sort of a way to relate to something so seemingly unrelatable. And her, by explaining that and adding those elements to this, you know, fantastical, imaginary element, she still keeps it grounded in reality and still finds a way for us all to relate to it and incorporate it into our lives ourselves, right? And she has a very deft way of doing that throughout the book with various things that seem so unrelated, but yet keeping them relatable. And I feel like this is how she's able to sort of both explain a Horcrux and also explain how you can relate to it.
Yeah, I mean, I like the way you put that. And that for us, you know, if we were to put ourselves in Voldemort's shoes, it would be the calcification of our soul because we continue to do bad things even though we know them to be wrong, and we do them anyway, especially and what's so fascinating is to watch and all for the idea of like power, you know, and so the ultimate form of selfishness is to, here we're seeing Voldemort try to prolong his life at the expense of others.
Yeah.
You know, and so in some ways, the one of the big fights in the Harry Potter series is about this idea, which is so much of what Star Wars is about, is between the selfish and the selfless. And these two things do not go together. And
they're mutually exclusive.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so I love that. What you described is the way in which we can see ourselves becoming like Voldemort, and the way she lays this out. So absolutely, I think it's phenomenal, because you know Voldemort seems so evil, right? But what he really is the person who does exactly what he wants whenever he wants to, without any regard for anyone else.
Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah. And that kind of lifestyle is one that is completely not only detrimental to one's own self, but to everyone else around them. And I love the way that she plays this out. And by giving us this background here with the Horcruxes, she gives us the opportunity then to kind of really get inside of that and be like, oh yeah, we could become that too if we're not careful.
Right. Yeah, so, for sure.
Yeah.
She kind of ends the chapter on that very deep moment, with all of that information. And we kind of know the next thing coming is a wedding. It's a wedding, y'all. It's a wedding. Yes, I can say the word
correctly.
Well,
it'll be interesting, because the first thing we're going to have is apparently the will of Albus Dumbledore. So that should be
fascinating. Right. That does happen.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. So
we get to hear what Dumbledore happens in his will, which we never even really thought about. And then after that, we get a wedding, y'all.
It's going to be fun.
Some toasts and some dancing and some old faces and some new faces.
Yeah,
there's a lot coming, and it's going to be really exciting for it all. And even the next chapter, I think, is pretty short, but there's a couple of really significant, there's some very, very significant things that happen in it, along with a couple of really important moments, too, for our characters. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited to see what happens.
Me too. But of course, you know, before we get there, well, we don't to the next chapter yet. So Drea, if anybody wants to catch up with you before we, you know, dive into that chapter, where can everyone find you?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
And I am on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero under the name MattRushing02. You can find me here on the network. I am doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills. It's a Star Wars podcast, as we are talking about a new Star Wars topic each and every week. I'm on the Trek FM network, where you can also find me doing two shows. One is called The Orb with Chris Jones. When we get a chance, we talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And then I'm doing our 602 Club show. And that is a general geek show where we're talking about all of the fandoms we love. So not just one, but it's a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying, as always, digging into something new each and every week there. But we want to thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.